So I just want to give a couple of disclaimers before I start tonight. One is that I was sick for a long time, so if my voice starts to go, please forgive me. I may be drinking lots of water. Hopefully that's mostly done. Two is that the presentation is a little bit long. I promise I'll try to keep it under 2 hours. I've been doing pretty good at that. I'm Eric's partner, and so everything sort of surrounding the case, I felt really personally, and it was really hard for me to figure out how to compact it all down into something that was digestible for other people and also not, 3.5 years long. So I apologize in advance for that. Also, everything tonight is based on my own thoughts and processes around everything that has happened. I'm not trying to speak for Eric or his family or his lawyer, anything like that. I'm only speaking for myself tonight. And finally, I'm not a lawyer and I have no legal training at all. So please don't take anything I say tonight as legal advice because that's absolutely not what it is. So just to give you a quick roadmap, I'm going to talk tonight first a little bit about the context in which Eric's case was created. Then I'm going to talk specifically about Eric's case, everything that led up to his arrest, take you through trial and sentencing, and then talk about a few things that have happened since then. Then maybe we'll take a quick break because it's kind of long. People can like stand up and use the bathroom or whatever. And then the second half is going to be more specifically about government repression, things like infiltration and entrapment. And we'll focus specifically on things that happened in Eric's case. On that note, I want to start off back in 2001 with a case of Jeff Lures, and he was arrested in Eugene, Oregon for burning three SUVs at a car dealership. The most alarming thing about Jeff's case was actually the sentence that he originally received, which was about 22 years and 8 months in prison. This outrageous sentence was clearly politically motivated. It was no secret that Jeff's actions were driven by a deep concern for the environment and the growing threat of global warming. Despite the fact that his actions harmed no one, which was not an accident, by the way, and caused only $40,000 in damage, the cars were even later resold. Jeff received a sentence much longer than many folks who are arrested and charged with things like rape and murder. This was clearly meant to send a chill throughout the environmental and anarchist communities. Jeff did appeal his sentencing, and about 7 years later, his sentence was overturned, and at his sentencing hearing in February, he was resentenced to about 10 years. This means that hopefully Jeff will be released by the end of this year. Jeff's case was not the first aggressive prosecution of environmental activists, and it certainly would not be the last, but it did signal sort of a change in direction for things to come. It was about 4 months prior to 9/11, which obviously caused a startling change in the political environment in this country, and a really horrifying crackdown on any sort of dissent. On May 26, 2004, six people in the organization called SHAC were indicted by a federal grand jury of animal enterprise terrorism. On March 12, 2006, all six were convicted of conspiracy to violate the 1992 Federal Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And basically, the act tries to punish anybody who physically disrupts an animal enterprise. And as we go through the presentation tonight, I really want people to think about the terms and the definitions that they're using here, because obviously to say that, physically disrupt is pretty broad and could apply to just about any sort of protest activity. The SHAC folks are all alleged to have operated a website that reported on and expressed ideological support for protest activity against Huntington Life Sciences and its business affiliates. They were charged with things like conspiracy to harass using a telecommunications device and conspiracy to commit interstate stalking. So the charges themselves may sound a little alarming, but none of these folks were actually accused of having personally engaged in terrorist or threatening acts. Instead, the government's case really centered around the idea that above-ground organizers of a campaign are responsible for any and all acts carried out by anybody else while furthering the legal goals of the organizers. For this, they were all charged with terrorism and served sentences running anywhere from 1 to 6 years in prison. On December 7, 2005, federal and local law enforcement began the largest roundup of environmental and animal rights activists in this country's history. The FBI called it Operation Backfire, and it soon grew into a nationwide series of subpoenas, arrests, and indictments. This is also what later came to be referred to as the Green Scare. All of the alleged acts were targeted sabotage against environmental criminals, logging companies, labs working on GMOs, energy facilities, environmentally destructive developments, etc. And none of these acts of sabotage caused injuries to animal or human life. Again, that was not an accident. Despite this, Attorney General Gonzalez held a press conference on January 20th, and the Department of Justice issued a press release both stating that the defendants were terrorists and indicating that they posed grave risk to human lives. None of the defendants were actually charged with the crime of terrorism, but the feds continued to use that in their PR, and those statements basically made crimes against property the ultimate evil, which allowed law enforcement to continue to gain vast resources from federal coffers, which was intended to fight terrorism, but instead ended up getting used to intimidate activist communities. Ironically, on the same day of these indictments, Michael Fortier, who was convicted for his part in the Oklahoma City bombing, which actually did kill 168 people, was released from jail after serving only 10 years. Again, in contrast, these folks were all being threatened with life plus 335 years in prison. Just for a little bit more comparison, these are the sentencing stats from 2008. You can see that arson usually carries about 7 years, murder 16, sex abuse 7.3, manslaughter 3.7. Again, the government asked for a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 years for these folks and were really pushing for life. If these acts had not been political in nature, the suspects would have been facing 5 to 10 years in prison. The government also sought the terrorism enhancement for all of these defendants, which is basically a legal tool that drastically increases a person's sentence regardless of their previous criminal history or the nature of the alleged crimes. Basically, by dangling the threat of these really ridiculous sentences over these folks' heads, the Justice Department coerced many of them into taking pleas and testifying against their former friends. Only 5 of these defendants maintained their integrity and refused to cooperate with the government. Daniel McGowan, Joanna Zacher, Nathan Block, and Jonathan Paul all pled guilty to the charges against themselves but refused to cooperate in the government's investigations of other people. And on December 22nd, one of the folks swept up in Operation Backfire was found in his cell after what was declared a suicide. Bill Rogers left a note which read, "To my friends and supporters, to help them make sense of all these events that have happened so quickly. Certain human cultures have been waging war against the earth for millennia. I chose to fight on the side of the bears, mountain lions, skunks, bats, saguaros, cliff rows, and all things wild. I am just the most recent casualty in that war, but tonight I have made a jailbreak. I am returning home to the earth, to the place of my origins." Bill's death was just a reminder of how much is at stake in these prosecutions. The sentences that actually came out of this particular batch of arrests range anywhere from 3 to 13 years. Obviously, there's a huge difference between what these folks are being threatened with and what they actually received. In my mind, that's a pretty clear reflection of the government's very successful attempts at intimidation. If the defendants had stuck together and not cooperated, the outcome of these cases might have been much different. In February of 2006, Rod Coronado was charged with distribution of information relating to explosives, destructive devices, and weapons of mass destruction. This charge basically stemmed from a talk that Rod had given in 2003, in which he answered a question from the audience about how he made an incendiary device in a previous action that he had already spent time in prison for. His lawyer was arguing that the statute under which he was charged violated the First and Fifth Amendments to the United States Constitution. The judge basically denied that motion and left it up to the jury to decide. The jury could not decide and declared themselves deadlocked. Unfortunately, at that point in time, the government began threatening to charge Rod with the same thing for some other talks that he had given that year. Understandably exhausted by spending years in legal battles and ready to move on to life with his family, Rod did accept a plea bargain, which did not require him to cooperate with the government, and he received a sentence of about 12 months. He was released earlier this year and is currently fighting some pretty outrageous conditions of release. So, the charges against Rod and the Shaq kids are particularly disconcerting in my mind because none of these allegations claim that the folks had actually been involved in carrying out any sort of direct action. All of the charges that I spoke about dealt directly with activities that I think most people would assume fall under free speech. The fact that the government was able to successfully prosecute those cases is pretty terrifying. Altogether, the cases that we just briefly touched on provide a small glimpse of how aggressively the government is pursuing prosecutions of people involved in environmental and animal rights. By labeling these folks the number one terrorist threat, the FBI has created much more than just a war of words. It is a war that has really devastating consequences for anybody who chooses to stand up for the Earth and her creatures. But I think Eric's case ended up being something maybe even more disconcerting, both in the way the case was created and how it all ended up. But before I launch into the specifics of Eric's case, I just wanted to show folks these quotes. I think the second one is really interesting because of the language that it uses. It talks about detecting, disrupting, and dismantling these movements. And this is from 2005 when the FBI started calling these groups the number one domestic terrorist threat. And then if you look at this quote from 1967, they're using the exact same language. They're talking about exposing, disrupting, misdirecting, discrediting, and neutralizing these movements. This is clearly straight from the times of COINTELPRO, although I hesitate to say that because it seems to me that COINTELPRO never ended. The government is using the exact same kind of tactics, the exact same kind of dirty work that they did before, and I think that folks would do really well to look at that history and learn from it. So it's really impossible to talk about Eric's case without talking a little bit about Anna. In August of 2004, Eric met a young woman named Anna at the CrimeThink convention in Des Moines, Iowa. She seemed energetic and knowledgeable, and he took an interest in her that soon grew into something more than a friendship. But Anna was not who she seemed to be. Her identity as a seasoned activist was a well-played act that concealed her real identity as an undercover FBI informant. According to her testimony at trial, Anna was 17 at the time that she began cooperating with the FBI. Her story is that she was enrolled in a class at a community college, and she decided that she wanted to write a paper about the FTAA protests that were going on at the time. So she went, as she said, undercover and attended various meetings and gatherings and then wrote a paper about it. She presented it to her class. They thought it was great. In particular, there was a cop in the class who thought it was super great, and he took it to his superiors, showed it to them. They gave Anna a call, and soon after, she was working for the FBI in an official capacity, paid to infiltrate and spy on groups engaged in legal protest activity at things like CrimeThink gatherings, the G8, the DNC, the RNC, and more. When Anna met Eric in Des Moines, she reported back to her handlers at the FBI that she thought he was harmless and not a person of interest. In fact, she testified at trial that the reason she was hanging out with him in the first place was that he felt safe and non-threatening. Despite this, she continued to seek him out at various protests, going so far as to email other people inquiring as to his whereabouts. Basically, she had her hooks in, and she used their relationship to entrap him in this alleged conspiracy. During trial, it was made very clear that when the group met on the West Coast in 2005, it was only because the government wanted the meeting to happen. Anna called Lauren and tried very hard to get her to come out. Lauren hated flying. They argued about it a lot. Eventually, Anna ended up buying Lauren's plane ticket and flying her out to the West Coast. When Eric expressed hesitation about the meeting, she called him selfish and basically pushed him into coming to the meeting as well. At the end of the meeting, they still had no plans other than to meet again sometime after Christmas. Despite the fact that this meeting in November was completely orchestrated by the government, they pointed to it repeatedly throughout trial as sort of the formation point of the alleged conspiracy. When the group moved into a cabin together in Dutch Flat, California in January of 2006, Anna drove Lauren and Zach all the way across the country in her own car from the East Coast to the West. The cabin that they lived in was paid for by the FBI. All of the supplies, the food, the gas, the computers, everything that they were using to survive at that point in time was paid for by Anna and the FBI. They would not have been on the same coast, let alone had a place to live, if not for Anna and the FBI. During trial, the burn book that the government referenced over and over again was full of so-called bomb recipes that were all written in Anna's handwriting. The tapes played during trial revealed a very pushy young woman who was constantly suggesting targets, pushing for more participation, and throwing full-on fits when people don't move fast enough, or, in her own words, can't stick to a damned plan. After about a week in the cabin, which I'm sure was very frustrating for Anna as somebody who was trying to make things happen, the FBI moved in and arrested Eric, Zach, and Lauren. The night before they were all arrested, they had a huge argument. Anna stormed out of the cabin. She said that she was angry because people weren't moving fast enough, and she always had to adapt to their changing whims. Unbeknownst, obviously, to the rest of the group, she left the cabin, walked down the street, and hooked up with her FBI buddies. She told them that she couldn't take it anymore, that she was done, and they told her at that point that they would arrest everybody the next day, which is what they did. This is the criminal complaint from Eric's case, and I think it's a pretty revealing document. It's about 15 pages long, and it uses the word anarchist, anarchy, or anarchism about 25 times in those 15 pages. It focuses not on any criminal history or nefarious criminal connections, because there are none, but instead on things like lifestyle and legal protest activity. Train hopping, hitchhiking, dumpster diving, and traveling are all discussed as if they were evidence of a criminal mind. It talks about crime think. It mentions evasion and days of war, nights of love. It specifies that Eric does not use a cellular telephone, which absurdly enough became a huge sticking point during the bail hearings. It talks about Zach's MySpace pages, which the FBI monitored and then tried to use against him. The criminal complaint basically made it really clear from the beginning that this case was not about a crime being committed, but about the government's rabid pursuit of people who lead lifestyles that they find threatening or unacceptable, specifically, in this case, obviously, from this document, anarchists. So Eric was arrested with Zach and Lauren on January 13th, 2006. He was immediately placed in what's called total separation, or solitary, where he remained for the duration of his time at Sac County Jail. It took about 2 years to bring his case to trial, and then he had to wait another 7 months for sentencing and transfer, so he spent about 2.5 years in TSEP. I don't know if I need to explain to people the physical and emotional implications that carried for him and his loved ones. He did not have a cellmate. He wasn't supposed to be out of his cell with other people. He rarely got to go outside, although outside at Sac County really meant like 7 stories up with a cement below you and a cage around you. It made visiting really difficult because nobody else could be up there when he was, so they had to block off the entire space for us. And then, you know, we'd have to like sign up for a visit in the morning, come back in the afternoon. I think perhaps the hardest thing for us, though, was that there were no contact visits at Sac County. So every time we saw him for the first 2.5 years, it was through a wall of glass, and we talked over a telephone. Obviously, that was incredibly difficult as we were going through some really intense emotional times. The first thing we had to focus on with Eric was bail. Eric and Zach were both denied bail from the beginning. Lauren was actually granted bail fairly quickly after her family put up about $1.2 million in the form of a vaquero bond. But even with that amount of money, we were all a little bit confused as to how she got bail so quickly. Obviously, that would soon be revealed. It was clear that Zach did not receive bail because his family didn't have the financial resources that the state was demanding for their ransom. But Eric's situation seemed a little bit different. It had less to do with money and more to do with how the government was targeting him as an individual. He was the oldest of the three and had a much firmer sense of self, for lack of a better word, a little bit more integrity. While I certainly don't claim to know what the government's strategy was, they had to have known, and other cases have actually played out very similarly, that if they could defy the co-defendants, they would have a much better chance at a successful conviction. Painting Eric as the ringleader certainly paved the way for this. Eric was actually denied bail twice. The judge claimed that he was a flight risk and a danger to the community. Both were completely ridiculous statements. Eric had no criminal history and had never been involved in any violent acts. The judge's evidence to support his claims, as I mentioned before, was that Eric knew how to live off the land and that he did not have a cellular telephone. The latter was clearly an indication in the judge's mind that he had no way to communicate with his family, which meant that he did not have strong family ties. Again, I don't think I need to explain to you how ridiculous it is to make that sort of claim, but that is actually what they were saying. This is just another interesting snippet that came up during the bail hearings. They're really targeting prisoner support a lot at this point, and one of the things that they were trying to say was, number one, that prisoner support was actually ELF, which is completely ridiculous. But number two, they were saying that, you know, if he got out on bail, that somebody would like whisk him away on some sort of underground railroad. Obviously, it was completely ridiculous, but I thought that was worth noting. Eric's co-defendants were actually granted bail as soon as they agreed to cooperate with the government. And this creates a pretty ridiculous situation in which somebody is considered a flight risk and a danger to the community as long as they maintain their innocence. And then the minute that they admit guilt, whether or not they're actually guilty is a different question entirely, but the minute they say they are, somehow their danger to the community and risk of flight magically disappears. This is just another way, in my mind, that folks who stand up for themselves are punished. Eventually, we had to let go of the idea of getting bail and settle into the fact that Eric would be in Sac County pre-trial. Again, this meant that he was in jail for 2 years before he was ever convicted of any sort of crime. And those were a long 2 years for a number of reasons. After about 2 months at Sac County, Eric tired of not getting any food that he could eat. He is vegan, and obviously Sac County was not very forthcoming with their vegan food. He decided to go on hunger strike, and we had to watch from behind the glass as he grew weaker and weaker. By the end of it, he could barely make it up the stairs to come to visits. He felt like he wasn't having any sort of meaningful communication with his lawyer or his family. Obviously, as he was trying to prepare for trial, that was sort of important. And so after about 2 weeks, he went off the hunger strike and filed suit against Sac County Jail. After that, he actually continued to get sicker and was losing weight. He was passing out. And I'm not sure what combination of things made the jail decide that they could start feeding him vegan food. Also, there were hundreds of people calling the jail at this time, demanding that he be given vegan food. So somehow, some combination of those things convinced them that they actually could feed him vegan food. And they did start giving him food until about a week before trial, they suddenly stopped again. Call us paranoid, but we couldn't help but think that that was a little bit more than a coincidence. Obviously, hunger striking while in trial was not really an option, but about 8 weeks after trial ended, Eric did decide to go on a second hunger strike. This one also lasted about 2 weeks. It was complicated this time by the fact that he was experiencing a resurgence of his pericarditis, which is a heart condition he had never had before his time in Sac County. The jail was not forthcoming with any sort of medical care. In fact, the only reason he got a diagnosis was that he was at a hearing in the federal courthouse, and the federal marshals saw how sick he was and actually took him to the hospital immediately. So now, the second hunger strike, people were not only calling about food, but also calling about getting him proper medical care. After about 2 weeks, he went off of the hunger strike, and at that point in time, they actually started feeding him vegan dinners. They never again started giving him breakfast or lunch, but they did tell him that they would change their policy around food to be more accommodating to vegan prisoners in the future. I have no idea if they've done that because Eric actually left before that was supposed to happen, and I haven't had a chance to follow up on it. So I think that there are a few things quite as scary as watching somebody go through hunger strikes and heart conditions while they're in prison. But I think that there are some things that are just as complicated emotionally. And I know when Eric's co-defendants flipped and started cooperating with the government, it was really awful. I can't imagine what that was like for him to have to endure that kind of betrayal, not only once with Anna, but then twice more with Zach and Lauren. Basically, what happened with Zach and Lauren was that in return for a lighter sentence, because the charge that they pled to carried a 5-year max instead of the 20 that Eric's charge carried, they agreed to fully cooperate with the government, not only against Eric, which included testifying against him at trial, but also in any and all future investigations that the government deemed them useful in. So this would be things like grand juries, future debriefings and interviews, trials, and other court proceedings. I just want to show you bits and pieces of the plea agreement because I think it's sort of interesting. This first piece is just saying that the court is not a party. So the government, when you agree to cooperate, can tell you, you know, we're going to argue that you get, you know, time served or 6 months or whatever. But the judge is actually the one who makes that decision. So the government can tell you whatever they want. If the judge still wants to give you the full 5 years, that's what he's going to do. This is the sort of detailing the meaning of cooperation. So again, you know, testifying at grand juries, trials, court proceedings, etc. And then at the bottom it says consequences of failure to cooperate. Basically what that's saying is if the government feels like at any point in time you have not lived up to this plea agreement, they can toss it out and charge you with the original charge, which again, remember, carries 20 years, not 5. And at this point, also keep in mind you've already pled guilty to something, so it'd be very hard for you to get out of that. This is some of the rights that you waive when you plead guilty. And this was just sort of interesting in my mind. At the end of the plea agreement, it says, no other promises or inducements have been made to me other than those contained in this agreement. No one has threatened or forced me in any way to enter into this plea agreement. If you ask me, threatening somebody with 20 years in prison and then saying, but if you sign this, it's 5, that sounds a lot like coercion to me, but apparently it's not. So Eric's case finally went to trial in September of 2007. And the government actually filed motions pre-trial to try to keep Eric from using the entrapment defense. Had they been successful in this, it really would have destroyed the almost 2 years of work that Eric and his lawyer had put into building his case. It was and is clear to anybody who looks at Eric's case that he was a target of government repression. His case basically has entrapment written all over it. This was really just a last-ditch effort by the government to deny any sort of wrongdoing and to sort of expedite Eric's conviction. But even the judge, who had already ruled repeatedly against Eric, had to admit that there was, in his words, slight evidence of entrapment, and he did allow Eric to use the defense of his choosing. This particular part of the motion just says, you know, that Eric was attempting to discredit Anna and smear the FBI. I'm going to show you some quotes from the jury a little bit later that really indicate that Eric didn't have to do that at all. Anna and the FBI did a fine job of discrediting themselves throughout trial and throughout their own testimony. So trial was a little bit intense, as you may have guessed. The government's main witness was Anna, and she spent over 2 days on the stand telling lie after lie about Eric. None of this was very surprising to us. We absolutely expected the government to play these sorts of games, but it was still pretty maddening to sit and watch somebody who was paid over $65,000 to destroy your loved one's life tell lie after lie about them on the stand. But I think perhaps even worse than watching Anna on the stand was watching Eric's former co-defendants testify against him. One of them, whom I had known in a previous life, or so it seemed, was a complete shell of his former self, basically a puppet to be manipulated and used by the government. The thing that I think was really terrifying about that was just watching the power of the state at work, that they could so completely dismantle a human being and make him completely unrecognizable to people who had known him before was a pretty horrifying thing to witness. We sat through days of government witness and testimony, but even their own testimony and the surveillance tapes that they played contained really damning evidence of government entrapment. And as the jury left for deliberations, we couldn't help but feel almost a little bit hopeful about what the outcome might be. And as the jury started coming back with questions for the court, those hopes didn't really seem too far-fetched because they were asking really good questions that indicated they were giving the entrapment issue serious consideration. Unfortunately, the court's responses to these questions were far from reasonable. The judge completely redefined the term predisposition, which is a key component of the entrapment defense, and obviously he redefined it to work in the government's favor. The government had to prove that Eric was predisposed to commit the crime before first contact with a government agent, which obviously was Anna. By telling the jury that Eric's first contact with Anna was in July of 2005, which was almost a full year after Eric met Anna, traveled with her, and formed a relationship with her, it completely altered the jury's process. Basically, it erased the entire year that they knew each other. The judge declared that first contact meant the first time that the defendant and the government agent talked about the alleged crime. Obviously, in a conspiracy case, which is all about talking, once a person is talking about committing a crime, they've surpassed predisposition. It renders the term completely useless. For example, in an arson case, it would be like saying that predisposition started when the fire was lit. So obviously, when the judge gave them these instructions, it altered the jury's process, and at that point in time, they decided that they could not acquit Eric. When they came back into the room to issue the verdict, we knew it was bad. None of them would look at Eric. A number of them had been crying. And obviously when they left, a number of them started crying again. We found out later that Mark and the news media talked to a number of the jurors after the verdict was issued. And what they had to say was really validating, but also incredibly frustrating because it seemed like a number of them wanted to acquit Eric, but thought that they were not able to because of the things that the judge had told them. There was one huge mistake that we didn't even know about until afterwards when these interviews were happening. One of the questions from the jury was Anna a government agent in August of 04? So in open court, the judge says, you don't need to write down the answer. I'm going to, you know, issue a written response to you when you get back to the jury room. In open court, he told them, yes, she was a government agent in August of 04. They get back to the jury room, and the written response says no. Obviously, that created some confusion, and a number of the jurors have identified that as the point at which they decided they could not vote to acquit Eric. These are some of the quotes from the local media that came out after the verdict was issued. Basically, they're just saying that, you know, Anna and the FBI embarrassed themselves, that they were biased, that they didn't have any control over Anna. A couple of the jurors actually submitted written affidavits prior to sentencing, that really just sort of outlined their disgust with the government and Anna. They said that the FBI was an embarrassment, that Anna was not credible. They said there was a strong case of entrapment. Had they been allowed to find Eric guilty of the lesser included offense, they would have. And basically what that means is if they had been allowed to find Eric guilty of the same thing that Zach and Lauren were found guilty of, they may have taken that option. And again, remember, that means Eric would have been facing 5 years max instead of 20. Eric's lawyer tried very hard to get that option for the jury, and the judge would not allow it. They said that Eric did not agree with Zach or Lauren to destroy government property. Obviously, that means there was no conspiracy. They said that Anna was actually the leader. The FBI was out of control, etc., etc. Again, none of this could really change the fact that Eric had been convicted. In some ways, I think knowing how close we had come made it even more painful and ridiculous. Obviously, the jury knew that they were making the wrong decision, and they made it anyway. In my mind, they made it because they were too afraid to challenge the authority figure standing in front of them, telling them what they had to do. Then we had to wait for sentencing, and it was originally scheduled for December, which was about 2.5 months down the road. It seemed like a really long time to wait. We just wanted to know what sort of sentence Eric would be facing and where he was going to end up. Unfortunately, 2.5 months turned into 7, and sentencing finally happened on May 8th of 2008. The government was asking for the full 20 years, and the probation officer was only recommending 13. In what should have been a very predictable move, the judge sided with the government and gave Eric 19 years and 7 months. Please keep in mind the nature of the alleged crime here. Eric is not accused of actually doing anything other than talking, of conspiring. Until recently, this was the longest sentence that we knew of for any environmental prisoner in the United States. Even folks who have pled guilty to multiple arsons spanning many years have received sentences ranging from 3 to 13. Eric's prosecution, conviction, and sentence were all used to set a very clear example of what happens to folks who dare to even think or talk of challenging the state. They set a pretty frightening precedent for things to come as well. Part of the reason that Eric received such a ridiculous sentence is that the government successfully applied the terrorism enhancement. Basically, it can be applied if the alleged offense is calculated to influence or affect the conduct of the government by intimidation or coercion, or to retaliate against government conduct. Again, please think about how broad these definitions are. This is basically the definition of dissent or protest. Anything that you do in protest is calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government. That's what it's all about. So this could really be applied to just about anybody. The way that the enhancement works is it automatically kicks a person's criminal history category up to a level 6, which is the highest level you could possibly get. It does this regardless of your criminal history, which again with Eric was nothing. He had no criminal history at all. The terrorism enhancement also has this tendency to follow people throughout their experience within the BOP. A number of folks who have had this applied have had their mail messed with, they've had phone calls restricted, they've had visits messed with. Some of them have been moved to what's called the communications management unit. Basically, folks who get moved here, it's like a super high security prison. They only get one 15-minute phone call a week. They get 4 hours of visits a month. And again, it's through glass. There are no contact visits. So it's pretty serious stuff for folks who get this. There's one other side note that I just wanted to mention that happened during sentencing. This is from Eric's pre-sentencing report, which is basically what the probation office says a person has to do after they're released from prison. And they were recommending mental health treatment for Eric to determine the source of his anti-government beliefs. So obviously this is pretty messed up for a number of reasons. It certainly smacks of some, you know, Orwellian deprogramming scheme. But I also think it's a pretty funny thing to ask of somebody who they just targeted, entrapped, starved, and then sentenced to 20 years in prison for doing nothing, and they want to know why he has anti-government beliefs. After Eric was sentenced, we were really curious to find out what would happen with his former co-defendants. We had to wait a long time for that to happen as well, about 7 months. Zach Jensen was sentenced to time served, which for him was about 6 months. On December 4th, 2008. To call that a sentencing disparity seems euphemistic at best. Originally, the government was asking for the full 5 years for Zach, but during the hearing, their position was that they were impressed by what they saw at trial and that he had turned his life around and jail time was not necessary for rehabilitation. Much of the hearing was spent demonizing Eric, and at the end, Zach declared that he wanted nothing to do with the life that he led 3 years ago. This was seemingly apparent from the sentencing declaration that he filed with the court, which was full of denunciations about his former friends. It is quite curious to me that somebody who acted so selfishly could point fingers at others and accuse them of the same. Obviously, the respect and compassion that he writes about here does not extend to the people that he sold out to the state. I think people were not so much upset with him about any sort of ideological dispute, but probably about the fact that he cooperated with the state, sold his friends out, and basically ended up giving his friend a 20-year prison sentence. Lauren Wiener was sentenced on December 11th, about a week after Zach. She also received time served, which for her was about 2 weeks. During her sentencing hearing, much of her cooperation was elucidated, and it extended beyond even cooperating against Eric. Anybody who had contact with Lauren after her release should know that their presence was absolutely reported to the FBI. Her lawyer used her extensive cooperation as leverage to gain a lighter sentence for her, claiming that giving her jail time would be counterproductive to the message of early cooperation and its rewards. Wiener called 2 witnesses during the hearing. One of them was a psychiatrist who her family hired to do an independent evaluation as to why she became involved. The psychiatrist spoke repeatedly about her lack of self-identity, her naivete, and her bad social judgment at the time of her arrest. Since her release, her psychiatrist has prescribed her a full regimen of drugs, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, and mood stabilizers. According to the psychiatrist, drugging her has produced a person that now has a sense of identity, an ability to say no, and she is no longer depressed or traumatized. There's one other side note about the sentencing hearings. One thing that came up again was the extent to which prisoner support was really being demonized. Prisoner support worked really tirelessly on Eric's case. They raised money for his legal defense. They fought really hard to get him vegan food and medical care. Prisoner support is a completely legal, integral part of many support campaigns for political prisoners, and the government tries constantly to vilify their work. During Eric's bail hearing, like I mentioned before, they were trying to say that prisoner support was going to, you know, whisk him away on the Underground Railroad. They also had copies of conversations that Eric had had with prisoner support while in Sac County about, like, what his rights were. They had copies of email alerts that prisoner support had sent out about how to, like, raise money for Eric or send him letters while he was in jail. During Lauren's sentencing, her lawyer also attempted to paint a very dishonest picture of prisoner support. He claimed that they were trying to pressure her to stay true to the ELF and that they were threatening her to convince her to not cooperate. Her lawyer offered no evidence to back up these claims, obviously, because there was no evidence. These claims were completely untrue. To claim that members of the ELF, which is an underground organization, would walk into a jail and threaten someone is completely ridiculous for obvious reasons. Eric's support crew are not the only ones who have faced this sort of targeting. For example, on the day of Marie Mason's sentencing, federal agents filled the courthouse and barred many people from entering the courtroom to show their support for her. As Will Potter wrote on his blog, this was a very clear attempt to intimidate Marie's friends and supporters. This was actually only the most recent step of very intense harassment of Marie and her supporters. They continuously attempted to use Marie's support campaign against her. And the government's motion to remand Marie into custody prior to sentencing. They claim that prisoner support would, again, like they did with Eric, whisk her away if she was freed on bail. They also listed numerous support sites in an effort to discredit her. In their sentencing memo on Marie, they claimed that they were not referencing efforts by her friends to support her. But who else do they think set up these support sites in the first place, if not people's friends and family? I know I've been jumping around a little bit here. I just want to, again, give people sort of the wider picture. After Eric's sentencing, we were pretty worried that he would be sent to a high-security facility just because of the length of the sentence he received and also because the terrorism enhancement was applied. So we were honestly pretty relieved when he got sent to a medium-security facility in Victorville, California, which is about 6.5-7 hours from Sacramento, which is where we live. Also, vegan prisoners in the past have not had problems getting food there. That has also been the case for Eric so far. He is appealing his conviction and sentence. Unfortunately, appeals are notoriously slow. It could be years, actually, before we hear anything about that. You can write to Eric. You can also visit his website to get all of this information, which is supporteric.org. There are a ton of documents as well on that website, so if anybody has a few 100 extra hours to kill. Like, all the transcripts from trial are up there now. Zach and Lauren's plea agreements are up there. a bunch of the motions that Eric's lawyer filed pretrial are there. As soon as the appeal is filed, we'll post it. So there's a pretty extensive history of the case there if you're interested. Unfortunately, it seems as if the repercussions of the precedent set by Eric's case and sentence are already being felt. Marie Mason was sentenced earlier this year in February for charges stemming from an action at MSU against genetic engineering. Marie was indicted after her ex-husband, Frank Ambrose, turned informant. Facing several life sentences if convicted, she did accept a non-cooperating plea agreement on September 8th. The government was actually asking for a 20-year sentence for Marie, but the judge took it upon himself to go a step further than this and sentenced her to an outrageous 21 years and 10 months in prison. This is now the longest sentence that we know of for any environmental prisoner in the United States, much longer than any of the Operation Backfire cases, despite pretty striking similarities between the charges. Eric's case was mentioned several times during Marie's sentencing hearing. Marie's lawyer was trying to argue that her sentence should be similar to those of the Operation Backfire cases because, obviously, the things that they were charged with were very similar. The government, however, pointed repeatedly to Eric's case and sentence as an example and said that, you know, here's this guy who did nothing, and he got 20. Obviously, the judge thought the government was right in this and gave her 21 years and 10 months. I also think it's important to remember that the feds are not the only ones pursuing these terrorism enhancements. During the RNC in 2008, 8 people were arrested and charged with conspiracy to riot in the second degree in furtherance of terrorism, which is a felony. This was the first ever use of Minnesota's 2002 Patriot Act. In December of 2008, the Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gartner, who is also running for governor of Minnesota as a Democrat, added 3 more felony charges. Combined, it was estimated that these charges could have carried about 12 and a half years in prison. But here's the kicker. Again, none of these folks were actually accused of carrying out any sort of direct action. In fact, they were all arrested in preemptive arrests before the convention had even begun. Minnesota's laws are obviously being used to target above-ground organizers and label them as terrorists. In a somewhat surprising move, Ramsey County Attorney's Office dropped the 2 terrorism enhancements on April 9th of this year. This was not due to any sort of change of heart or moment of sanity on the part of the government, but was the direct result of months and months of very intense organizing and agitation on the part of the RNCA and their support. They are still facing, obviously, the 2 conspiracy charges and still need your support. In March of this year, 4 people were arrested, indicted, and charged with violating the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a piece of federal legislation that passed in 2006. Basically, the AETA makes it a crime of terrorism to damage or interfere with the operation of an animal enterprise. Again, think about how broad these definitions are. The folks charged under this new law, as laid out in the indictment, are charged with basically what amounts to participating in home demonstrations or protests against people involved in animal research. None of them are even accused of having committed any sort of violence, vandalism, or sabotage. As currently charged, I believe each of these charges carries about 5 years. The case will be the first real test of this law. If the prosecution is successful, it will set a pretty frightening precedent for the way in which this law could be used in the future. Although, honestly, this really isn't anything new. Again, remember the Shack case. This is very similar, and the AETA is basically just a further expansion of the Fed's power to pursue animal and environmental rights activists. And in April of this year, 2 folks were indicted for alleged actions stemming from their work against I-69, which is a massive NAFTA infrastructure project. The project threatens thousands of acres of land and will displace hundreds of families. Hugh and Tiga have both been charged with 4 misdemeanors and a Class C felony. The felony alone could carry 8 years in prison. So again, I just wanted to, I feel like every time I do this presentation, I have to add more and it's really depressing, but I just want to give people sort of the larger context here and remember that, you know, there are many things that sort of set Eric's case apart, I think, as far as the use of informants and like the sentence that he received and all that kind of stuff. But it really is part of a broader agenda here on the part of the government. And I think it's really important to keep that in perspective and in context when we're talking about it. I want maybe to take a quick break. Please don't go anywhere. We're going to talk about infiltration and entrapment a little bit. But yeah, maybe just stand up and stretch and use the bathroom if you need to. Okay, so I'm going to talk tonight about entrapment, conspiracy charges, and infiltration. And I wanted to talk about these things because, unfortunately, they're becoming more and more of an issue for folks involved in any sort of dissent. You know, I think sometimes folks think that they are maybe immune from this because they're engaged in, you know, like very legal sort of sanctioned, you know, holding signs on the street corner kind of protest. And I think most people know that even those kind of groups have been infiltrated for years. And so anybody who thinks that they're immune from this is sort of deluding themselves. But I do think it is especially important for folks involved in animal and environmental rights activism, because this has become more and more of an issue for that group in particular. But I want to back up even more than that and say that obviously for folks involved in things like the Black Panther Party or AIM or any sort of indigenous resistance have been facing this kind of thing for a very long time. And again, we would do really well to look at that history, make connections with those folks, and learn from it. Obviously, we don't have time to do that tonight. But, and again, disclaimer, especially in this half, perhaps, not a lawyer. It's not legal advice. Please don't take it that way. And I'm only speaking for myself. So I wanted to start out talking about entrapment. Case law is pretty varied and open to interpretation on most subjects that come up in any courtroom. But I think usually what it comes down to is what the judge tells the jury they have to consider when looking at the evidence in any particular case. For Eric, the jury was given these instructions about entrapment. So the government has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was not entrapped. They have to prove that the defendant was predisposed to commit the crime before first contact, which we've talked about, or that the defendant was not induced by the government agents to commit the crime. So what does this mean? I don't want to get too lost in semantics here, but definitions are important, so we need to know what predisposition and inducement actually mean. Predisposition simply means that a defendant would have been inclined to commit the crime even without government involvement, and inducement is government conduct that creates a substantial risk that an otherwise law-abiding citizen will commit an offense. According to a brief filed by the government in Eric's case, this would be things like persuasion, fraudulent representation, pleas based on need, sympathy, etc. So this all seems sort of straightforward, but it gets incredibly tricky when arguing the details in a trial situation, because both sides are trying to offer proof of something that can be incredibly hard to prove: a person's intent, their will, or their personality. The old saying, actions speak louder than words, is quite applicable here. People can talk for days and days about things that they may or may not do, but until they actually do them, who's to say whether or not they are predisposed? Coupled with the fact that part of being human is possessing the power of choice and free will, that we can change our hearts and minds at any time and often don't do so until we are smacked in the face with the most difficult decisions, proving that somebody is or is not predisposed seems like a pretty impossible task. Perhaps that is why the overt act was created, and here we need to delve a little bit into what conspiracy means. Conspiracy charges, in my mind, are particularly alarming because no actual crime is ever committed, or at least what we think of as crime. People are virtually charged with thinking or talking about engaging in acts that the state has defined as illegal. To prove conspiracy, the government has to establish three different things. Again, these are specifically from Eric's case. So number one, that there was an agreement between the defendant and at least one other person. That other person, by the way, is not supposed to be the informant. Two, the defendant became a member of the conspiracy knowing of at least one of its objects and intending to help accomplish it. And three, one of the members of the conspiracy performed at least one overt act. So what, you might be asking, would qualify as an overt act? According to the prosecutor in Eric's case during closing arguments, the mere fact of coming together at the cabin was an overt act. He went on to say that searching for sites on the internet about chemicals was an overt act, and that the moment they hit the start button on the computer, that was an overt act. The tangent continued with him stating that visiting San Francisco was an overt act, and he said these defendants were guilty the moment Lauren Weiner bought The Poor Man's James Bond, which is a book. So there you have it: buying books, surfing the internet, renting a house with some friends, switching on your computer. Any of these could be considered overt acts. Virtually anything that a person does in their day-to-day life could be construed as evidence of criminal activity. I think that this is just one more example of how the government holds all the cards, making and breaking the rules of the game at will with complete immunity. And if the law does not seem to be working for them, they simply rework it and redefine it to fit their needs. By Anna's own testimony, remember, Eric was not predisposed when she met him. She said he was safe and harmless. When they played transcripts from trial, when Anna asked Eric what had radicalized him, the only thing he could point to was his relationship with her. To get around this little snafu, the government again convinced the judge to redefine the term predisposition and first contact. As far as inducement, based on the definition that the government gave during trial, Eric and Lauren and Zach were all absolutely induced by Anna. She pushed, cajoled, she promised romance in the future. In their responses to Mark's accusations, they simply justified Anna's behavior by citing a really ridiculously long list of other cases in which informants had engaged in outrageous behavior and just gotten away with it. The bottom line here is that the government is quite skilled at bending and manipulating the law to make it work for them. Folks should never assume that the law will protect them. That is absolutely not what it was designed to do, and to operate under that assumption is folly of the worst kind. So I want to switch gears now and talk a little bit about government informants. There are guidelines laid out by the Attorney General's office detailing how government informants are supposed to work. Scant evidence exists that government agencies actually follow these guidelines, share them with informants, or even know what they are. In 2005, a report was released that showed, in an analysis of 120 informant files, the Justice Department found that the FBI violated procedures in 87% of the cases. During trial, Anna actually testified that she had a telephone conference in Philadelphia with the FBI about the Attorney General's guidelines. She said she had never had a hard copy of the document in front of her, but that it was summarized during this phone call. During his testimony, her handler, Agent Ricardo Torres, testified the last time he reviewed the guidelines was at 12:45 that afternoon when the FBI faxed them over to the prosecutor's office for him to read. As her handler, Torres was responsible for Anna and for making sure that she did not violate the guidelines. But when asked by Mark if informants were allowed to solicit people to come to political protests, Torres said he didn't know. When asked if an informant can't do anything that an agent can't do, he said he couldn't recall. Perhaps they don't feel the need to waste time on such paperwork and oversight, resting comfortable with the knowledge that they operate with near immunity when challenged in court. And this is all, of course, assuming that informants are under the supervision of a government agency in the first place, because there are different kinds of informants, and some of them are much more insidious. Anna was hired and paid by the government. Her original designation was CS or CI, which is Cooperating Source or Confidential Informant. And then later she received what's called OIA status, or Otherwise Illegal Activity. At that point, the FBI could begin legally, at least, recording her conversations. She wore a body wire at all times. Her car was wired. She might have also had a wire in her bag. Her cell phone conversations with others were also recorded. And when they moved into the cabin in Dutch Flat, the cabin was wired with audio and video surveillance. All of the equipment running the surveillance was actually kept in the garage of that cabin. Anna told the others that the landlord kept his things there, and that's why it was locked, so they never checked out. Not all informants are hired from outside and paid by the government, a lesson folks have been painfully taught over and over again these last few years. Perhaps the most infamous of informants is Jacob Ferguson, who was involved in over a dozen cases of arson and vandalism, mostly in the Pacific Northwest over a period of many years. The FBI originally approached him in 2001 with a subpoena for a grand jury. Instead of testifying, he basically agreed just to talk with them and told them he had nothing to do with it. They approached him again in 2003 and he agreed to fully cooperate. Some say that cooperation was in exchange for money, but it was most definitely in exchange for drastically reduced sentencing. In the spring of 2004, he traveled around the country, visited his former friends, reminiscing about old times, and basically baiting them to incriminate themselves, all the while wearing a wire. These conversations and the word of Ferguson formed the basis of the government's case and all of those Operation Backfire cases that we talked about earlier. In the end, 15 people were indicted for those actions, and all of them are now spending 3 to 13 years in prison, all of them except, of course, for Jacob Ferguson, who received absolutely not one day in jail in exchange for his great efforts on behalf of the FBI. Unfortunately, this was not the last time that folks would cave under government pressure and deliver their former friends into the hands of the state. Remember Marie Mason's case earlier? Her ex-husband, Frank Ambrose, actually turned informant and did very similar things to what Jacob Ferguson was doing. He wore a wire, he went to EF gatherings, he talked to people, he recorded phone calls, and all of those ended up in four people being indicted in the same case that Marie was indicted in. Perhaps one of the most alarming cases of informants to come to light recently is that of Brandon Darby. Darby was a longtime social justice activist. He had worked in a number of radical communities, including 6 years in and around Austin, and as one of the driving forces behind Common Ground in post-Katrina New Orleans. A statement put out by the Austin Informant Working Group reads, "Darby has been characterized by many people who have known and worked with him as both persuasive and manipulative, with a history of provocation, instigation, and incitement. The FBI documents make it clear that Darby did not restrict his informing to people he alleges were planning illegal activities. He also gathered information on numerous people who were engaged in lawful activism, including some who had no plans to attend the Republican convention." Darby's involvement with the FBI actually goes back to at least February 2007, although some information suggests he may have been working with them as early as 2006 or before. I think the most disturbing thing about the case of Brandon Darby is that, like Anna, he was not only an informant, but also a provocateur, entrapping two young men during the RNC in 08. Both were charged with possessing Molotov cocktails. Bradley Crowder pled guilty soon after his arrest, but the other, David McKay, went to trial in January. After 3 days of deliberation, the jury declared themselves deadlocked. McKay had made very strong claims of entrapment against Darby, and obviously at least some of the jury found them to be very credible. McKay was set to be retried in March, but in a very alarming turn of events, under circumstances which seem rather confusing, he suddenly changed his plea to guilty the day before his trial was set to begin. He was sentenced to 4 years, and Bradley received 2. I think with cases like Ferguson, Ambrose, and Darby, it's a different kind of complicated because these are folks that had been around for years, that people had already deemed trustworthy, that they'd worked with in the past, and I think that really gives folks a false sense of security when they're talking to them. Then there are folks, of course, like Eric's co-defendants, Zach and Lauren, who flip and cooperate against their former friends. I'm not going to go into great detail about this because obviously we've already done that. So I realize this all paints sort of a grim picture, and I really don't want the end result of this to be that everybody's afraid. I just really want to give folks a sense of how government informants operate, how these cases sort of play out. And to that end, I want to talk a little bit more about Anna, who she was, how she operated, and how the government used her to entrap Eric. According to the affidavit in Eric's case, Anna was involved in the prosecution of at least 12 other anarchist cases. She was used by the feds for this very specific purpose, to infiltrate the anarchist movement and deliver to them successful prosecutions, which of course could then be used as an example to drive fear into the hearts of anybody else who dared to stand up. A lot of people have wondered if there were any sort of warning signs that could have been indications of who she actually was and what her intentions were. Obviously, there are no hard and fast rules here, and it's tricky because if we're afraid of each other, then they've already won. So we need to keep that in mind when we're talking about this. Nothing I'm going to show you is meant to be a clear-cut sign of infiltration, but just very specific examples of how this particular person operated. So this is Anna, and she's posing for Elle magazine here, an internationally distributed magazine. And the interesting thing about this is that throughout Eric's trial, the government went to great lengths to keep her identity a secret. They would not let her speak her real name on the stand. They would not let anybody take pictures of her. They would not let the courtroom artist draw her face, ostensibly because, you know, they were concerned about her safety. But then, you know, a few months later, here is her picture in this internationally distributed magazine. Clearly, she was not particularly concerned about her safety. When Anna appeared on the scene, her story was that she was a medic. Perhaps she thought that that would facilitate the building of relationships. She wore the garb of a medic. She carried a medic bag. But reports from folks who met and interacted with her at this time, apparently she was the first to disappear from the scene as soon as anybody actually needed medical attention. These are some emails from Anna to other folks. The one on the top left is just her asking around about these other gatherings. She's wondering who else is coming. The one on the top right, I think, is really interesting. It says, "Brutal, it'll be a reunion. Do you guys need anything? Supplies, paint, chains, nails, pipe, anything. Tar and feathers, like I said, disposable income. So ask around all your contacts. It'd be safer to bring from outside as well. So what are we going to do?" Obviously, she's suggesting a few things here, which she is not supposed to do. Also, I think it's interesting that she talks about disposable income. I don't know how many of you know anybody else with disposable income, but I certainly don't. And this is something that she actually did a lot. When she was with the other folks, she would literally pull $100 bills out of her pocket and hand them to other people to buy groceries or, you know, gas for the car or whatever. Her sort of cover story was that she was a stripper and she had all this money saved up. But I certainly can't imagine how even that would give you the sort of stash to keep four people surviving. So that was sort of an interesting part of her story. The one on the bottom left, she's just asking around about D. D is Eric, for those of you who don't know. So again, she was sort of just targeting him from the beginning and even asking other folks about where he might be. So this is from the 302s, which is part of the discovery or the evidence that comes out in a case. This particular 302 is just a breakdown of the surveillance that the FBI was watching from the van as it happened in the cabin. At 10:14 p.m., you see it says, Wiener discusses the revolution. I want to play you the surveillance footage from 10:14 and see if you think whether or not they're actually discussing the revolution at 10:14. Okay, so they're actually talking about a movie, not the revolution. And I think this is just a really poignant example of the way the government will take the smallest statement and completely twist it and turn it until it's not even the same thing anymore. And they did this repeatedly to Eric throughout trial, and I think it's important to keep this in mind too, because I know a lot of times when, you know, somebody gets arrested, these horrible reports will come out and they'll put out all these press releases about all these horrible things that these people were planning or saying or whatever. But it's really important to remember that the government lies and they make things up a lot. And so, and this is also just a really good example of that. A lot of the stuff that I'm going to play, I'm just showing you because I think it's pretty indicative of the way that Anna would like push people and suggest things and try to get them to do things, even though obviously they weren't that into it. And this is just another example of that. Also, I think it's interesting just to pay attention to, like, the language she uses and the way that she talks. Okay, this is the what do you want to do? Okay, I'm gonna skip goals and go to I said stick to the plan.
How about we talk about tomorrow after dinner? Would that be okay? No? You want something right now?
I was writing down a plan. I would be able to follow it much better. But when we just talk about it and focus plan is this,
we have an idea that
we had a schedule on our bus for all week. And we had a schedule of.
Yeah, that's true.
It's good, sorry. Okay, I'm going to skip over a couple of these because there's a million. Obviously, we don't have a million hours. The next one is just an audio clip. It's called Have You Done This Before? And I think it's just important to think about the way that Anna would get people to talk about themselves and maybe things that they had done in the past. But not even just themselves. She was very good at getting them to talk about other people they knew. Lauren was particularly bad about this and told Anna tons of stories about her friends and things that they had supposedly done. This particular conversation is between Anna and Zach, but I think it's a good example of that sort of conversation. I'm just going to play one more. I'm going to play the Leader One conversation. The government really tried throughout trial to paint Eric as the ringleader, and I think this conversation is just one of many examples that I think that Lauren and Zach felt like maybe somebody else was the leader, and this conversation is a very clear indication of that. The reason I included the first part of this conversation is that I just think it's, again, interesting to listen to the language that Anna uses. It's not, the first part of the conversation, she's talking about how she was in the National Guard. I really don't think she was. But again, it's just sort of interesting.
I feel immensely for the individuals that I interacted with, but for suckers like me, that are over in Iraq right now, that freaking... But they had no control on nothing to do, and they got fucked.
Yeah.
But for the institution, and the really the overarching reasons, and the bigger picture behind all that, yes, it does make me, seed with anger, really want to freaking fix it, do something, change something. That makes sense? I mean, if you're asking if it made me angry and want to, destroy it, that's the answer to be asked. What are you thinking of that?
I don't know, I had a really silly paranoid thought last night while I was really stoned. That you were still, mententally fucked up from being in the National Guard.
No.
That were, go crazy and, being responsive.
No. Hey kid, I'm fucking not your leader.
I know, but that's what it is. But then I realized, hey, that's really silly pairing of that.
Yeah, it is. I haven't done any coaching.
I think that conversation is incredibly eerie. So the leader two conversation, which I won't play, is just Anna trying to say that Eric's the leader, and Zach's like, no, he's not. No, he's not. No, he's not. The radicalized conversation is the one that I referenced before, where Eric says that Anna is the reason that his politics are changing. And then the Zoe conversation is a little confusing and hard to figure out exactly what's going on, but it sounds to me like Lauren is calling Anna's cell phone. She hears her message. There's a different name on it. And, you know, Anna, of course, plays it off like, oh, of course that's not my name. But I think it's just, again, her stories did not always line up, and people weren't really paying attention to that as much as they should have been. So what can folks do to protect themselves from this sort of government intrusion? Again, there aren't any hard and fast rules here, and I don't want people to take any of this as that. But we can look at Anna's behavior and the sort of things that she did to get an idea of how these folks operate. Again, she was very good at getting people to talk about things that they or others had done. Lauren, in particular, was very bad about that. She would often tell people that she was, you know, conducting an informal study, or she just wanted to know how people became involved. She asked questions about people's political histories with alarming persistence. Eric and Zach actually knew Anna for a long time before they were arrested, and during that time, they never once met her family or went to her house or went to her workplace or met her dog or any of her other friends. All of those seem like things you might want to do with a trusted friend. And obviously, romance is not indicative of safety. Eric and Anna had a relationship on some level during the time that they knew each other. He wrote her love letters. They talked about their relationship. And basically, that relationship was used and manipulated by her and the FBI to entrap Eric. Remember that phones can be tapped, emails read, cars and houses wired. Emails are easily subpoenaed by the government, and almost most email providers are all too quick to comply. In the search warrant for Eric, Zach, and Lauren's email, the government requested not only the contents of their in and out boxes, but also their entire contacts list, so that huge list of like all your friends and their email addresses. Folks should never assume that their emails are secure. Cars and houses obviously can be wired. At one point, Lauren asked if they should be worried about Anna's car being wired, and Anna sort of, you know, pretended to be upset and said, I can't believe that you would think that I'm not on my own shit. I would know if my car was wired. Of course it's not. Obviously, a person could never know if a particular thing or place was wired. Anybody who tells you otherwise either doesn't know what they're talking about or is lying. As for cell phones, Anna's main form of communication with the FBI before she started wearing a wire was her cell phone. She sent text messages to stay in touch with them, told them where they were, where they were going, what they were planning next. She was very loath to be anywhere without her cell phone. In late 2006, a U.S. district judge ruled that the FBI can use people's cell phones as a roving bug. Basically, what that means is that the phone can be remotely switched on and the microphone activated to use it to eavesdrop on nearby conversations. They can do this without the person who owns the phone having any way of knowing. The phone does not have to be powered on for this to work. Supposedly, Nextel and Samsung handsets and the Motorola Razr are especially vulnerable to these kinds of software downloads. Perhaps the only way to ensure that a phone is not being used as a monitoring device is to remove the battery completely, although, you know, who could be certain that that even would work? And delete your MySpace, your Friendster, your Facebook. The cops and the feds absolutely use these on a daily basis, sometimes even employing people for the specific task of scouring these databases for information on activists and their friends. Even if you think you aren't putting anything damaging on your account, keep in mind that this is an easy way for them to keep track of your whereabouts, your friends' friends, and all of their contacts. It also helps them to create profiles of their own as they find new ways to infiltrate organizations and groups, and at the very least, this provides them with a very easy list of folks to harass for questioning should somebody be arrested. And obviously, don't talk to the cops ever. As much as you may think you are helping, or that you don't know anything, or that you don't have anything to hide, it is always a bad idea to talk to them. You are not required to, and you shouldn't. If you have never had a Know Your Rights training, I highly suggest you get one. If you have had one, a little refresher course is always helpful. And this is just a sort of funny comic about informants. Unfortunately, it's also very true. And I just want to stress again that the laws are not there to protect you. That was never its intended purpose. When a person can get thrown in prison for 20 years, For what basically amounts to thought crime, something is clearly broken. The thing that I always come back to with Eric's case is the fact that, you know, the jury really knew that they were making the wrong decision. And again, I really think that they were just afraid to challenge this sort of authority figure in front of them that they thought was telling them what they had to do. I think if people would start making choices for themselves and, you know, really acting from their heart, that the world would be a much different place. And I really think that Eric's life would be much different if those few people had chosen to do that. This quote is from the stones outside the federal courthouse in Sacramento. There's all sorts of quotes out there about justice and civil liberties. I don't really know how this one made the cut, but I really like it. And I thought it was sort of a nice note to end on. So again, Eric's website is supporteric.org. And does anybody have any questions about Eric or his case or anything that we talked about?
Did the other people, like other informants that you mentioned, did they also kind of have this disposable income story thing?
I don't know too terribly much about the other folks. I mean, remember, like, with Ferguson and Frank Ambrose, it wasn't even about that. I mean, all they had to do was, you know, wear a wire and go talk to their friends about stuff. So that obviously wasn't the issue. Trying to think, Brandon Darby is a completely different story. And there was actually an interview with him recently on This American Life that was really interesting. And I'm sure you can find it online and listen to it if you want to know a little bit more about him. Just, you know, listen to it with a critical ear and remember he's probably lying because that's what he does. So it's an interesting story. But, I mean, I think that if you even look outside of not just environmental and animal rights cases, but like sort of the wider picture of a lot of these like terrorism cases that are happening and the informants that they're using. One of the cases actually right now that's happening up in New York, these folks, I think it was three guys were just arrested on terrorism related charges, but the stories coming out about the informant are very similar as far as, you know, this person like paying for everything and like they were living in a house that may or may not have been paid for by this person. And so it seems as if this is definitely like a tactic that they're
picking
using, you know, is like, hey, we'll pay for your shit if you come do this thing. So,
because I know I read a thing about in the UK, a girl came forward and she had police had approached her because she's an eco activist, I believe. And they had approached her and she had actually got them on tape trying to entice her and telling she could have they were saying, we have unlimited funds for you, like, just work for us and get, you know, try and get people to say things and we'll give you all this money. And so she got it on tape and came out with it. And they actually gave her a lot of information and told her, yeah, we've been just recruiting people from all these different things and we've got people everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to imagine that's probably going on in the States as well. It's just someone hasn't been able to get it on tape yet and come forward. But it's pretty scary, the scale of what's going on.
All right. Music. There's music. Stay around.
Thanks.